Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Today is the 9th of September 2013 here in Japan, and today I'm joined on the line from the United States by Kevin Ryan, the author of a brand new and very important book, Another 19, Investigating Legitimate 9/11 Suspects, talking about who really perpetrated the attacks of 9/11 and what suspects we can hope to bring some sort of criminal proceedings against in those attacks. So, Kevin Ryan, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, James. It's good to be with you.
Well, Kevin, I hope that people have listened to my recent podcast in which I highlighted your work and exhorted people to go and read your new book. I would once again exhort them to read this book. It is a very important work that I think has really expanded the scope of 9/11 truth research and really expanded the discussion beyond the same few talking points that have been regurgitated for a long time now in the 9/11 truth movement. So it is an extremely detailed, extremely dense book, an extremely lengthy and in-depth book on these 9/11 suspects that you posit as an alternative 19 to the 19 hijackers armed with box cutters directed by a man on dialysis in a cave halfway around the world that we are expected to believe actually perpetrated these attacks. It is a very remarkable work, and let's just talk about why is it that you decided to write this particular book? What prompted you to begin this investigation?
Well, I've been studying the events of 9/11 for 10 years now, and for the first 6 years, I focused primarily on the World Trade Center and the scientific aspects of how the buildings might have been destroyed. And in addition, I've been part of a number of groups that have been calling for a new investigation into 9/11. And unfortunately, the options with regard to a new investigation into 9/11 largely focus on what we might be able to do with another U.S. government investigation. Well, I thought that it would be useful in the meantime to begin answering some of the questions that have not been answered by the previous government investigations. There's some very serious questions that have not been answered, and I tried to outline what those were and start to answer them with suggested alternatives and suggested suspects. So the idea with the book is 19 alleged hijackers were blamed for the events of 9/11 in total. And so can we think of 19 others who might have had more access, more power, and more ability to actually accomplish the crimes and answer those unanswered questions?
Well, it is a noble effort, and I think you're right to locate the focus of our investigation on that, because, of course, those are the absolute prime principles that any criminal investigator would use to try to identify suspects in any crime, the means, motive, and opportunity, all of which seem to be lacking for these 19 hijackers who we're expected to believe actually perpetrated this attack on the most sophisticated air defense system in the history of humanity. But let's talk in some detail about these 19 suspects. It ranges, there's quite a range of suspects involved here, people from the military-industrial complex, people from the White House itself, people from the intelligence apparatus, people from private industry. If you were going to categorize the different categories of suspects, what would you say generally? What are the groupings of people who are who you posit as potential suspects in this crime?
Well, there are different groups, as you said. There are military leaders, a few of those. There are government representatives. There are business leaders and people who I would say are just nondescript, maybe deep state operatives. That's the term that I go into in the book. I start to look at whether or not 9/11 could have been what is called a deep state operation. And so there are a few people in the book who are just appear to be covert operatives and working for fronts in some cases, like Stratesec, the company that had so many connections to security for the facilities that were impacted. And when I looked at the people that were possible suspects, I noticed that there were 19 of them, at least, that were strongly connected to two men who were in perfect position to coordinate the attacks, and those two men being the vice president at the time, Dick Cheney, and the secretary of defense, Donald Rumsfeld. And so all of these 19 suspects are linked to these two men in some ways, in some cases, in many ways, over a period of 30 plus years.
Well, that's a very important point, the point that this attack could not have been coordinated without the help of the Vice President and the Secretary of Defense for a number of reasons, given their responsibilities on that day and how they signally failed to live up to the call to defend the United States on that morning. Let's talk in a little bit of detail about Dick and Don, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, and specifically their history in the lead-up to the 9/11 attacks going back decades in preparation for just this type of event.
Yeah, there's some very interesting things related to deception in the careers of Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, and that's why it's important to look at them with regard to the possible deception behind 9/11. For example, they were obviously connected for many years. Dick Cheney was basically a protege of Donald Rumsfeld back in 1969 when they were joining the Nixon administration. And then they went on to become very powerful figures in the Ford administration at a young age. And over time, they went in and out of government. Cheney was a congressman, and Rumsfeld was a various Mideast envoy and various roles while he was in and out running companies as well. One thing they did have in common throughout all that time that I found was very intimately linked to the events of 9/11 was the plan for continuity of government. And this was a project that was implemented back in the 70s and 80s to replace the U.S. government at times of crisis. And originally, it was intended as a response to a strike by the Soviet Union, a nuclear strike that would disable the government, and therefore people like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld would come together and basically represent the United States as a replacement government, in so many words, eliminating the U.S. Constitution in the same time. And other people that were involved in this small select group included Richard Clark, who was the counterterrorism czar for the United States in the 9 years prior to 9/11. But when we say deception leading up to the Gulf War, for example, Dick Cheney and another of the suspects in the book, his protege, Dwayne Andrews, were behind the lies, really, the false satellite imagery that helped to start the Gulf War, claims of Saddam Hussein massing troops at the Saudi border, for example, and the young lady Naira from Kuwait who claimed that Iraqi soldiers were taking babies out of incubators. That lady that young lady was also related to us, the owner of the Stratesex parent company, Kuam Corporation. So Dick and Don on 9/11 had very important roles. Dick, obviously, the head person in charge of the White House in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center. Donald Rumsfeld, the second half of the National Command Authority, unfortunately seemed to have removed himself from any effective role by moving out into the Pentagon lawn and parking lot for half an hour at the height of the attack. So there's a lot more, obviously, we could say, and this short interview won't cover it all, but Dick and Don seem to have been in perfect position to be in charge of what happened.
Well, as you note, if the thesis is that this was some sort of deep state operation and is related to the national security apparatus in general, it is very interesting, as you go on to point out in the book, the number of people that you point as legitimate suspects in this crime who have direct links or even experience with special operations or other black operations in the past. Let's talk about some of those connections and some of the people who have had that direct experience, who found themselves in positions of some importance on that morning.
Well, yes, one of those people would be Richard Armitage, who was the Deputy Secretary of State on 9/11, and therefore he was in charge of the Bureau of Consular Affairs in the 9 months prior to 9/11. That means that he was in charge of the programs that gave visas to the alleged hijackers. Therefore, the evidence provided for the alleged hijackers comes through programs that were managed by Richard Armitage, and he was a special forces soldier in Vietnam. He is known to have been a covert operative as well. He's suspected to have been part of what was called the Phoenix Program, a mass assassination program in Vietnam, where over 20,000 innocent people, allegedly, well, we don't know for sure, were kidnapped and murdered, and tortured and murdered. Other people who were special operations specialists include Lieutenant General Michael Canavan, who was, at the time of 9/11, the hijack coordinator for the FAA. He had just come to the FAA from his role in the special operations groups of the United States. He had been the head of the Joint Special Operations Command, which later was responsible for killing Osama bin Laden, we're told. And so this man, who was a special operations commander and hijack coordinator, had been in charge of tabletop exercises prior to 9/11 that, according to FAA intelligence officer John Hawley, were pretty damn close to the 9/11 plot. And so this man, being a special operations commander coming in right before 9/11, not really being effective in any way, claiming to have been out of the office that morning with no one backing him up, and then leaving the office just a month after 9/11, is very suspicious. Another special operations soldier was Brian Michael Jenkins, and he was again in Vietnam as well, again suspected of being part of the Phoenix program. And throughout the 80s, he was accused, during the 80s, he was accused of running a terror war in Central America on behalf of the Reagan administration. This man is very interesting in the fact that he was the deputy chairman of Kroll Associates, which company in the 1990s designed the security system for the World Trade Center after the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. So Brian Michael Jenkins, as a special operations soldier, career special operations soldier and RAND counsel, was another example. So there are people like Duane Andrews, who I mentioned earlier, who was a special operations soldier in the Air Force in Vietnam, and then became Dick Cheney's right-hand man for many years. And there are others, but that gives you a flavor for the idea of why I suspect 9/11 had a special operations bent to it.
Well, you've mentioned a few corporations now. Perhaps we can take a moment to explore some of these companies and their potential role in these attacks. We've talked, for example, about Kroll and Kuam Corporation and Stratesec. Why don't you outline what these companies were and why they're so interesting with regards to 9/11 specifically?
Well, Kuam Corporation, for example, it was the company that was a parent of Stratesec. It was the security company for the World Trade Center that implemented the overall electronic system for the World Trade Center complex. It was also had contracts for Dulles Airport and for United Airlines and for National Laboratories of the United States, which are interesting with regard to energetic materials. Kuam Corporation was the Kuwait American Corporation, and therefore it was owned largely by the Kuwait government. And, of course, this is interesting in that the Kuwait government benefited greatly from the removal of Saddam Hussein after 9/11. And they were also very closely related to the Bush family in many ways. Stratesec itself had on its board Marvin Bush, the brother of the president, George W. Bush. But it had this chief executive officer, Wirt Walker, whose family really has ties to deep state operations going back to the days of the Opium Wars in the Russell and Company group that bought up so much infrastructure in the United States. I also mentioned the Carlyle Group many times because that was run by its chairman, Frank Carlucci, but it had two subsidiaries for operating for operations, one being the Vanel Corporation, and the Vanel Corporation basically propped up the Saudi Arabian regime for many years from the 1970s. But the more important one to the book is BDM International, because BDM International provided employees of Stratesec came from BDM International. An important one being Barry McDaniel, the chief operating officer of Stratesec, who took a very unusual career move, moving from BDM, which is making trillions of dollars in contracts in the Middle East, to this small company, Stratesec, that was struggling along on contracts only for the World Trade Center and for Dulles Airport at the time. It was also the time at which import contracts were being gained by the company for the security programs at the World Trade Center. It was also the exact time that fireproofing upgrades were going on in the World Trade Center that happened to match up ultimately to the exact floors where the planes struck the buildings, the towers. I talk about a company called Science Applications International Corporation, SAIC, that was run by Duane Andrews as its chief operating officer. And SAIC has a multitude of connections to 9/11 that we can't go into detail on here. But suffice to say that it's so strongly connected to the link to the events of 9/11 and to the causes of the assumed causes of the failure to capture the hijackers, to prevent the hijackings, to the buildings themselves and the explanations for how these buildings were destroyed, to the capture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged architect of 9/11. SAIC provided the man who ran the robot program at Ground Zero and therefore scanned the debris pile, robots that had been used for elimination of unexploded ordnance in the past. So these companies really give cause to say, could it have been that these private corporations, linked to intelligence agencies in many ways, had some sort of role in causing the actual events of 9/11 to occur? And I try to go into that in the book.
And you do so in a great degree of detail, so we'll once again refer people to the book for that. But speaking of companies that happen to be in the impact zone and were deeply related to what was happening on 9/11 from a financial point of view is a company like Marsh & McLennan. Let's talk a little bit about that aspect of the attack.
Yeah, Marsh & McLennan was very interesting. When, again, you look at the fireproofing upgrades as an example, in the North Tower, the fireproof was upgraded for the floors 91 through 99 out of 110 floors. This was the exact zone where the plane hit the North Tower, where the fires raged, and where the government says the buildings first failed. So when I started looking at this company, I noticed its executive, who is well-known for other things. His name is L. Paul Bremer, who ran a division of Marsh after leading the National Commission on Terrorism, and he had just put out a report, along with Brian Michael Jenkins, who I mentioned, in June 2000. And basically, the report recommended giving more power to the Department of Defense. It recommended exercises being run by Richard Clark. But this commission basically was a final step, it seemed, in a series of commissions that helped to transform what was once the threat of a Soviet attack on the United States or Soviet terrorism into what we now call Islamic terrorism, which is sometimes difficult for us to understand given the tenets of Islam. But that was an effort that Bremer and Jenkins were a big part of. And I talk about Bremer in many other ways. He was located in the towers, actually in the South Tower. So it's very odd that this man who is the leader of the National Commission on Terrorism and who had in the past claimed that the World Trade Center was essentially a good target for terrorist event would be located in that exact spot on the day of 9/11. He, as some others, luckily survived the attacks, and instead of being a victim, he spent the day on television giving us what ultimately would be the official account of 9/11, blaming Osama bin Laden, blaming Iraq, and blaming Iran, and calling for a major military strike on those targets.
And Marcia McLennan, of course, is interesting in and of itself as one of the world's largest professional services and insurance brokerages in the world. And one of the interesting financial aspects of what happened on 9/11 is something that was revealed in the months after the attacks. A number of the companies that were affected by the attacks hired a company in Germany called Convar to examine some of the hard drives that had been recovered from the Ground Zero. Apparently, as many as 400 hard drives were recovered, 39 of which were examined in the first few months. And at that time, an executive from Convar was quoted as saying that they had discovered as much as $100 million in anomalous and unexplained transactions had been discovered on those, the records of that had been discovered on those hard drives. And that was a very interesting investigation that I have never really seen followed up since then. I don't know anything about what's happened to the rest of those hard drives, whether Convar has ever continued with that investigation, whether Kroll Associates bought out Convar is something that I've heard floated as a rumor on the internet, but I've never seen anything to back that up. What has your investigation showed about that aspect of the event?
Well, that touches on a category of information that we call 9/11 insider trading, although technically it was related to massive credit card transactions, it appears, and transfers of cash that were completed in the buildings that morning or the 24 hours before 9/11, and then the computers were expected to have been destroyed, therefore destroying evidence, apparently. As you said, Convar recovered the hard drives from some of those computers. And they said they gave evidence of what was called doomsday dealings. So basically, people knew that something was going to happen to those computers in those buildings and conducted operations financially just before that happened. I had actually written a broad review of 9/11 insider trading 2 years ago, and it was published in a book by Jesse Ventura last year. But insider trading goes from everything from stock trades to treasury bills to these credit card transactions. And what people don't know is that a dozen governments around the world were convinced of 9/11 insider trading to the extent of opening investigations. And those investigations largely fell apart over time after the U.S. Investigation essentially came to the conclusion that the people who allegedly were involved had no links to Al-Qaeda, and therefore it could not have been 9/11 insider trading. That's an argument that's a very poor to begin with, but some of those people that were named in the SEC Securities and Exchange documents that highlighted those trades were people like Wirt Walker, who we mentioned from Strategic, and people who were in league with FBI agents who had been later convicted of conspiracy. So there's a lot of strong evidence of Wirt Walker and some of these other people being connected to Al-Qaeda. So I think the basic premise in itself is doesn't hold water.
It's a reminder of the circular reasoning of NIST, and that we don't check for explosives. We didn't test the explosive hypothesis because there was no evidence of explosives, which, again, is the type of circular reasoning that we're dealing with here. Let's talk about the intelligence apparatus of the United States, which obviously would have had to have been involved in this type of operation. And when we look at that, of course, two of the suspects who raise their heads immediately would be the head of the CIA and the FBI, at least in the lead-up to those attacks, talking about George Tenet and Louis Freed, respectively. Let's talk about those individuals and their connections to the event.
Yeah, I begin talking about that because I'm trying to answer the question in the book, how could it be, given what we know about the alleged hijackers and their activities, for example, how could it be that our FBI and CIA were not able to track down and capture these people? And so an example that many people point to are the two alleged hijackers who lived in San Diego with an FBI informant, Abdusattar Sheikh, and who had been brought to him by another FBI asset, a tested asset, Omar Al-Bayoumi, it was his name. And both of these men appeared to have been Saudi-linked executives of companies or Saudi operatives. But in any case, the two alleged hijackers, Al-Madar and Al-Hazmi, lived with these this FBI informant for a number of months and just before the attacks. And so how could it be that the FBI would not be able to track down these men? So I looked at the director of the FBI at the time, Louis Free, who was director from 1993 to 2001, June 2001. And I found some very interesting details on him and how it appeared that he either ignored or facilitated terrorist attacks throughout his career there, or the FBI did under his guidance. And so, going back to the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center and how FBI crime lab people said that the evidence was skewed in order to support a predetermined conclusion, and then the Oklahoma City bombing. And there are a great deal of connections between the Oklahoma City bombing and the crimes of 9/11, including the fact that there was a lot of activity in Oklahoma City from the alleged hijackers visiting airports to Zacharias Moussaoui training at the airport that was at the University of Oklahoma, where former Senator David Boren was president, and he was also the mentor of the CIA director, George Tenet. And so I show a lot of interesting connections again to Stratesec, because the Wiley Post Airport in Bethany, Oklahoma, where the offices of Wirt Walker's aviation companies were located. And it turns out that today those offices are occupied by the man who was the trainer of Zacharias Moussaoui. It seems like a strange coincidence, but again, FBI connections go from Ali Mohammed, who was a known trainer of Al-Qaeda and who was also a special forces soldier in the United States Army, and an FBI informant who was captured in 1998 and has still not been brought up on charges. Often it is said he was allowed to plea bargain when he was captured. So the FBI did not appear under the guidance of Louis Free to be interested in actually capturing terrorists and prosecuting them. George Tenet is the same. George Tenet was accused of Alec Station Chief Michael Scheuer of having prevented or obstructed 10 attempts to capture Osama bin Laden. And this is a leading FBI officer, Michael Scheuer, basically saying that it was Tenet who prevented the capture of Osama bin Laden many times. But whether that's true or not, we do know that George Tenet did nothing to prevent terrorism. He did not even order a national intelligence estimate in his long tenure as CIA director on the subject of terrorism until just before 9/11, and that had not started on the day of 9/11. And he had been in the office since 1997. No national intelligence estimate on terrorism. Again, his connections to David Boren and Boren's activities and the hijackers' activities in Oklahoma lead us to further worry what these men were doing. I would just say one other thing related to 9/11 insider trading. The SEC had flagged another company called Visage Corporation, V-I-I-S-A-G-E. It was a Homeland Security technology company on facial recognition technology. And both Louis Free and George Tenet joined the board of Visage Corporation in 2006, a company that had been flagged for 9/11 insider trading, never investigated, and still not investigated after the two leading intelligence community leaders joined it after 9/11.
Well, I think that speaks for itself. Why would it not be investigated after they have joined the board? Well, that again points to the complicity of not only the former directors of the FBI and the CIA, but of course the subsequent ones as well. And I think the cover-up of these suspects is another important aspect of this, and one that we'll come to in a moment. But let's just continue on with talking about some of the suspects. And obviously one of the key aspects of understanding what happened that day is understanding the complete and systematic undermining of the air defenses. And in that regard, not only do we have Michael Canavan at the FAA, but we also have people like Sliney. We also have Ralph Eberhardt over at NORAD. Let's talk about the air responses and some of the suspects related to that.
Yeah, I think this is important for people to understand that, for example, the 9/11 Commission wrote a 570-page report of which only two chapters really deal with the events of 9/11, and only one major aspect of the crimes of 9/11 was covered, and that was the failure of the air defenses. Now, the problem with it was that it was providing the fourth distinct story that had been given by the military for those failures. And so when I started looking at this in detail, I had to start with Ralph Eberhardt, who was the general in charge of the NORAD group, the military group in charge of air defense. And Eberhardt, again, goes back to Vietnam. He was a soldier in Vietnam. He was put in place as NORAD commander and commander of SYNC, of the U.S. Operations Space Operations Command. So he was SYNC Space and SYNC NORAD after General Myers gave him that, transferred that role in 1999. But what's important to understand, not only were there four distinct stories, but the original timelines given by NORAD gave very specific times at which NORAD was notified about these hijackings. That they said they were given 47 minutes on Flight 93, 24 minutes on Flight 77, and so forth. And ultimately, the 9/11 Commission told us a totally different story and said that they weren't given notice on any of those planes other than the first one. And that's why they were not able to scramble planes in time to intercept the hijacked aircraft. But NORAD was running some very coincidental exercises that morning, one of them called Vigilant Guardian. And these exercises were under the sponsorship of Ralph Eberhardt, the NORAD commander. And things we know about these exercises were that they were mimicking, in some cases, the events that were going on that day. Vigilant Guardian had an exercise on September 9th, which planes were hijacked, and attacks on New York City were planned. So on September 11th, there were plans for simulated hijackings at 9:30 in the morning. And the people in the response centers said that they felt that maybe these exercises were just starting a little early. Maybe they were starting an hour early. And the records show that have been released by the 9/11 Commission, the records show that these people were definitely confused by these exercises and the events going on. They weren't sure what was an exercise and what was not. If you look at the planning documents, it says that the simulated injects, the false radar data of false hijacked aircraft, were to be overlaid over live radar data, sim over live. It's right in the planning documents for Vigilant Guardian. It says in these documents that these exact centers, the NEED Center and the Cheyenne Mountain Operations Center in Colorado, were play exercise areas for that morning. They were expected to be part of an exercise, part of a play, and everyone there was expected to be part of it. Now, that just happened to be the exact time when these planes started being hijacked. And so, you know, what we see in the documents, in the multiple false stories, that is, it appears that the 9/11 Commission came up with a story of its own, in so many words, or came up with it from some origin, and then ultimately convinced the NORAD, the military officials who had been testifying, that they needed to change their story and go along with it. But some people, like Ralph Eberhardt, didn't look like he needed much convincing. Another being Colonel Robert Marr at NEES, didn't need much convincing. So the 9/11 Commission seemed to be in cahoots with NORAD in providing this fourth, completely different account in the 9/11 Commission report.
Well, Kevin, you have outlined a number of legitimate suspects in 9/11 who any serious investigation would have looked into and their connections. But of course, what we were provided was not serious investigations of what happened on 9/11. Let's talk about that aspect of it, because of course 9/11 wasn't just about the events themselves, but then the ongoing cover-up after the fact. And who are some of the individuals who we can point to as being responsible for the inability for investigators and researchers to really come to the truth of what happened that day?
Well, one person that I highlight in the book is Porter Goss, and he's a suspect in the book because of his activities in the cover-up of the events. Now, he led the joint congressional inquiry along with his colleague Bob Graham from Florida. But Porter Goss was a CIA operative for many years in the 60s and 70s. And not only that, it was claimed, and there appears to be photographic evidence, that he was part of an assassination group called Operation 40 that's connected to some very interesting characters and possibly to drug running in the Mexico area. And so anyway, Porter Goss led the congressional inquiry, but it's curious because he and Bob Graham were meeting with Mahmoud Ahmed, who was the general in charge of the Pakistani ISI. And that's interesting because the Pakistani ISI, as I point out in the book, was inseparable from a known terrorist financing network and possible operation network called BCCI, which it runs through the book as one of several themes, in that there were many connections from lots of these suspects are connected to BCCI in some way. And so the morning of 9/11, Porter Goss is meeting with General Ahmed, and then after the attacks, he's hired to run this joint inquiry, which has a very limited scope. It was just about trying to explain why the FBI and CIA did not capture or prevent the attacks. Some of the things that were clear were that both Goss and Graham were not really interested in revealing the truth. The members of the panel stated that they were totally in control. They didn't want the panel, the inquiry members, to speak to outside personnel, media, or outside government officials. They not only did that, but as the joint inquiry was investigating the FBI, Goss and Graham got the FBI to investigate members of the panel itself for supposed leaks of information. So in an absurd circular manner, the inquiry was investigating the FBI, and the FBI was investigating the members of the inquiry. Of course, this led to no actual revelation of the truth. But when we get back to these two men who were alleged hijackers living in San Diego with an FBI informant, you get a gist for what really was going on with the inquiry, because this sheikh, Abdusattar Sheikh, who was an FBI informant who lived with the alleged hijackers, was not forced to testify. He was not compelled to testify. He was not compelled to even take a polygraph test, which was absurd given the fact that, you know, after 9/11, we started capturing people like Abu Zubaydah, who was allegedly a top operational manager of al-Qaeda, and torturing these people and putting them in secret prisons. And yet here's this man who we know lived with alleged 9/11 hijackers for a period of time and must have known something about al-Qaeda, must have been able to help us. But the joint inquiry did not compel this man to testify. He ultimately was released by, from any involvement in the investigation. And that seemed very absurd. Now, the 9/11 joint 9/11 inquiry also recommended accountability boards for certain people. George Tenet actually was the CIA Inspector General report that recommended these accountability boards of certain people. And Tenet, who later became the director of the CIA, did away with that as well. So even the minor reviews of the behavior of George Tenet and certain people who seem to have been involved in preventing the alleged hijackers' capture, those reviews were eliminated as well by Porter Goss.
Now, I sympathize with people who are listening to this conversation and are just being overwhelmed by a flood of information, names and facts and dates and corporations, etc., and struggling to create a type of mind map that encompasses all of this information. And to the extent that people are struggling with that, I do sympathize with them, and I hope it at least gives them a taste for how much information is contained in this book, which once again I will recommend people go out and read for themselves, because we cannot do justice to it in a short conversation like this. But given that there are these 19 suspects, and of course many others as well that could be included on a list like this, that we could probably have 1 hour conversations about each of them individually, let alone all 19 of them together. But given that there is so much overwhelming evidence, and the fact that this has been so thoroughly covered up for the last 12 years, and there seems to be little indication that that's going to change anytime in the near future, I suppose the question is, what do you want to accomplish with this book? What do you hope could be accomplished? And perhaps you can start by telling us about the dedication of the book. This book is dedicated to future generations.
Yes, this book is dedicated to future generations in the sense that hopefully people who follow us will have some resources to reach to put together a sensible worldview, given that we suspect that terrorism will continue, unfortunately, because we don't know exactly who committed the crimes of 9/11. It does appear that there are many powerful people who were in position to accomplish the attacks. And so history is one of those things. We have to make sure that history is available for people who might be looking for answers in the future. But also, I really hope to compel or to urge other independent investigators to take this sort of approach, to start answering specific questions about 9/11. How could these buildings have fallen through the path of what should have been the most of resistance? How could our air defenses have failed just for those 2 hours that morning, and so on? How could the chain of command have failed completely on 9/11? Asking questions like this and providing sensible alternative answers, things that actually fill in the holes the 9/11 Commission left empty, I think that's useful. And, you know, as I think there's a chance in the future that there will be an alternative media as well grown in our country, that maybe together with them we can start pushing for independent investigation that will lead to justice as well. Now, I point out that there were victims from 59 different countries on 9/11. And really, as independent investigators and activists, we can pursue those avenues as well, I believe. If we make it clear to leaders in some of those other 59 countries and see if any of them are willing to pursue an investigation of their own into the deaths of their citizens, that may be useful. And other than that, you know, I think what's really important is that as we learn more, there's a possibility we can avoid future attacks. There's a possibility we can reveal the possibility of attacks before they happen if we know where these attacks are coming from, or we have a better sense of that. So that's a big part of the book as well.
Well, it is a noble effort, and you certainly are speaking with the alternative media right now, what may be in its early nascent stages that hopefully will be able to develop into a movement that will be able to really shape the political discourse in the future in a greater and greater fashion. So your book has been out for the last few months now. What can you say about the reception that you've had so far?
Well, the book is doing very well. The reviews of it at Amazon are strong. You know, I'm heartened when I see people like yourself who have a good amount of knowledge of the events of 9/11 already receive it positively. Another person from 9/11truth.org, Mike Berger, just wrote a very nice review of the book. It's strongly supported by several 9/11 family members and other leading researchers who wrote blurbs for it. So it's been well received. It's doing very well. And I think my hope is that it distributes well enough that people in different countries start to realize that we here in America really are trying to take responsibility for some of the things that have gone on or continue to go on in our country. We have an obligation as Americans, just as any other citizens in any country, to take responsibility for the actions of our government. And so hopefully that other people around the world will see that, and that when we as Americans start to suffer some of these similar kinds of, hopefully not, but similar kinds of pains that we are inflicting upon the world, maybe they can take it with a grain of salt and say, there are some Americans who care and they're trying to get the truth out and realize what's happening.
Well, once again, Kevin, we've only begun to scrape the surface of what you've uncovered in your book, so I will once again direct people to it. It's called Another 19, Investigating Legitimate 9/11 Suspects, and of course I'll provide a direct link to that book in the show notes for this interview, as well as a link to your website, digwithin.net, where you continue to release some of the most important and detailed essays and investigations, I think, that are currently ongoing in the 9/11 truth community. So it is a pleasure and an honor speaking with you today. And I hope we get to speak to you again in the future. Kevin Ryan, thank you for your time.
Thank you, James.